Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight, hey, another great show dealing with metaphysical subjects and spiritual subjects and some science issues and always, always something surprising and maybe a little different than what you might expect we're really going to be talking about. You never know from those titles what we might get into. I thought tonight we'd deal with converting personal relationships to soul ones. Now, of course, I'm going to explain what that means in a minute, but before we even go any further, I want to sort of put in, like, hey, this is the we'll say, rule of exception here, and that is that anything I say about doing this very thing should be applied with the knowledge that, at best, you're going to succeed 1 out of 5 times, and at worst, maybe 1 out of 20 times. So you got to really, really consider that it's not so easy to do and that the success rate is very low. So why do we have a show about something that's so low in success? Because if you do manage to do it, for every time you manage to achieve this goal, you've got a new, we'll say, closer relationship with whoever you're dealing with. You've helped the world in general because people are more soul conscious. And it helps you to try to do this because your own consciousness has to be raised even if you fail. And failure is not on a personal level. Failure comes from the other side, I mean, in most circumstances. So it is, provided you follow the suggestions and that I'll be discussing in today's show. There's lots of ways to fail personally on your own side as well, but that's a whole other subject, and we will deal with some of that today. But nonetheless, this subject is really important because there are so many people that I talk with who have this as an issue. I mean, they don't necessarily talk about it like this is the issue. You know, they don't define it quite exactly the same way. But the bottom of the situation is that it is. This is the problem. My friend, my spouse, my children, my extended family, next door neighbor, business associate, working fellow workers, teachers, students, classes. I mean, it goes on and on. How do I deal with this problem? So it's vast. And even people, now this is the most difficult part, even people that we don't know all that well. Now, the opportunity for success is extremely low. But regardless, it's still prevalent. And that's the concern. Okay, so what do I mean by converting personal relationships to soul ones? Well, let's start with a soul relationship, because most people have a pretty good understanding of a personal relationship, but a soul relationship is a relationship in which the other person and you have already established a reason for your continued involvement together, no matter what else takes place between you and them. So if you have a soul relationship, that soul relationship is forever, because no matter what other things take place, you might even dislike each other on a personal level. But if you have a soul relationship, that relationship will sustain itself and last indefinitely. Souls themselves live indefinitely in consciousness. The soul body may change various ways. The consciousness may be raised various ways. But souls never die in consciousness. And their relationships, once based upon their consciousness, which is what we're talking about, that never ends either. That's the reason why it never ends. Okay, so once we've defined that, and we have, now what... how is that different from a personal relationship? Well, personal relationships always end. Yeah, they always end. Why is that? because without there being a soul relationship added to a personal relationship, the personality itself ends. Okay? The personality only goes on if it fuses or becomes one with its soul in a specific lifetime. All personalities eventually die if they haven't done that. So all relationships based upon personality die eventually. Now, how is that a big deal? You're like, oh, what's so big about that problem? Well, it's huge. Because, you see, when your relationship is based upon the common understanding that it's doomed to end through death, boy, I make it sound terrible, don't I? Doomed to end through death. How's that? The personal relationship, then, is inevitable. It is inevitable that before it ends, it's going to be filled with strife, fears, big issues, and we'll call it almost irreconcilable differences from the get-go that only compound themselves based upon the individual fears of each person personally. Mm-hmm. Now you can say, whoa, wait a second, hold on. I got the exact same fears as my spouse. It's great. We're going to really coincide. Well, yeah. You think you do. The problem with that issue is that unless you know when and how and under what circumstances each of you are going to die, you don't. So that is there may be a handful of people who absolutely have that information at hand, maybe because they're going to kill themselves together or whatever. But you know, they belong to the Hemlock Society. There is such a thing. There is. You know, if you don't know about it, you can read about it. And they've decided to carry out their own deaths from the physical world. And maybe they don't believe they're going to go on, but if they do, even if they do, they're eventually going to keep doing the hemlock thing somehow, so that they're always going to have this perfected element of death in a certain way together. And they could possibly contradict my statement, but how rare is that? Come on. That's, you can count those people on probably your hands and toes. So it's a small number, and obviously not, and remember, it has to be coincident. And so we're not talking about, you know, people say, well, if you die, I'll kill myself within 10 years. No, it doesn't matter. It would have to be together because the fears surround the exact circumstances. And so it gets a lot more involved than just like saying in a general way, well, if you die, I'll suddenly kill myself. And I've known people who have actually carried that out, but a few, very, very few in my lifetime. All right, so we have this almost, we'll say, untenable position that a personal relationship has with anyone else that revolves around the fact that the personality has an inordinate fear of death. And now I'm going to tell you the other inordinate fear that personalities share, and that's of control. And here's where it really gets interesting. Each personality wants to be in control, but it wants to do so in a fashion in which no matter how close it is in a relationship with or to someone else, it still seeks the supremacy position of control, even over the other person. So there's no such thing as a truly, perfectly balanced situation of control between two personalities because they seek the uniqueness of individual control, not the shared position. No matter how much they declare themselves to be communists or otherwise, they are not going to have that in the reality of the nature of the personality. Why does it do that, you ask? Well, it was designed that way, unfortunately, to be in control, to keep us alive during the first, say, 10 years of our life. It's very important to recognize that without the personality, children are highly vulnerable to killing themselves by accident. And so there's all kinds of issues. Now you can say, well, they're not 1 or 2 or 3 years old because we could keep, you know, yeah, up to maybe the toddler era, you can get away with claiming that you can guard the child against them. But, you know, eventually you can't. As soon as they can run around the house, and then when they go outside, you know, I mean, there's infinite ways that they can cause themselves harm. And so, and the world is like that. I mean, we don't live in the most comforting places in the universe here. So it's a difficult place, a difficult thing. So the personality has a job to do. Keep us alive for as long as it seems possible, and safe and secure, and also to stay in control of the overall person, which includes the lower self. Now, this is another difficult part of the explanation. The lower self is the part of us that consciously sees itself as an individual. The personality is subconscious. It's the real boss, though. So it says, okay, I like having a self. It's kind of cool. Because that's a part of me that is conscious and says, hey, I'm really an individual. I do this and that different than other people. I'm really special in my public. Okay, and I like that. That's cool. And it builds up my ability to control others, which I really like, because if I can control others, then I ensure that I'm going to stay alive longer, and I ensure that all the things that I desire and that my feelings and everything will feel good, it'll be happy, and also later in life when I think about things and it's important, my thoughts become more important to me, I'll be in a supreme or a higher position than others if I'm in control of them too. So this is really a great thing. Yeah, right. All right. But this is the position the personality takes. So it says, well, having a lower self is pretty cool. Yeah, it can learn all kinds of things, be special and everything, and it can show off to people. Of course, you don't want to make it too obvious, but because then you'll scare away the people who also have their own personalities. They're thinking that I really am superior to them, and then there will be a struggle. So they kind of know how to make it look like they're not doing that when they do it. But at any rate, that's the whole thing. But there is a problem with that kind of lower self development. And that is, it's consistently vulnerable to growth and creativity, which always leads to failure. In other words, if you're going to have a self, a lower self, that exceeds or excels in both, exceeds and excels other personalities and their selves in creativity and and developing, therefore, greater amounts of self, which is in some ways good, but it's a double-edged sword because that's what leaves us vulnerable or open to failure. Yeah, that's the problem. So you find people who are very strongly fearful, which means personality controlled, being fearful of creativity. That's what they're really fight for, and growth. And so they keep their selves, the little self, from growing very much because anything new that they got to grow about can lead to this real problem of failure. And that causes the personality to lose control. And it causes the person then to question things of a personal nature with others. There's all kinds of problems that come out of this question of creativity and growth. All right, so then how do you solve this problem? Well, the solution is to grow more of and with God instead of the lower self. And when you do that, you grow something called the higher self, which is highly creative. As a matter of fact, way more creative than the little self can ever be, because it isn't constricted by the personality. It totally is unaffected by the personality, and it is fully conscious. So everything it does is fully conscious. The lower self is only partially conscious. It's conscious of the results that are favorable towards the personalities continuing to have control. When the lower self grows in ways that are against the personality, the subconscious part of the person, from maintaining control in circumstances, there's a battle. There becomes an internal battle that goes on inside the person. And that internal battle, I know this is getting a little complicated, and for those of you who really want to know more about this, go to Chapter 5 of Life's Meaning, and it spends a lot of time talking about this issue. But so what happens is the person then is in an internal battle, and that internal battle becomes a real battle with other people and their personality as well. So these cause what is known as personal conflicts. And it really starts from inside. It's not from outside. Everybody says, well, these circumstances arose, and now I have this problem with blank, blank. There were no circumstances that ever arose. What happened was you had a conflict with somebody from the get-go about that situation, and when the situation arose, because it was there, and both of you recognized it, then the conflict became, you became aware of the conflict. But the real conflict is inside of them. Okay, it's inside, and it's about growth. It's about being creative together in ways that allows them to be free from the fears of the personality and the over-controlling nature of the personality. Remember, the personality first wants to control its lower self, and then it wants to control the lower selves of others. So, first it's us that we're trying to deal with, then it's others. Okay, so if you follow me so far and you are confused, good. If you are, you can always re-listen to this part of the show. This is not easy. I know these defining things that I do in the first 40 minutes, it taxes everybody, They all go, oh, are we doing a concept thing again? All right, so, and it also is taxing because it's every time I do this, I do it in almost every show, right? Every time I do it, I am dealing with the very subject we are talking about tonight. I'm trying to put a little more wedge between that personality and ourself and trying to get us to look up into God and our higher self, which is, we'll say, an analog for our soul, and trying to get us to become more of our soul. That's what these defining things are. That's why you have resistance to hearing it. That's why it sounds so hard. Because you don't want to hear it. I don't really think they are that huge of a concept, but they're difficult because of the resistance to hearing it before anything else. Okay. So, getting back. That was an interesting aside. Right, to throw that in there, yeah. So we get back down to this issue. Okay, part of us then has internal conflicts with our lower self when suddenly we want to create and grow in ways, well, almost in any way, that challenges the control of our personality or subconscious part of us. Remember, that subconscious part, we could only conjecture about it, because if it was conscious, if we were conscious about it, it wouldn't be subconscious. And we'll talk about that too, just a couple more minutes. So literally, the obvious objective, is to become fully conscious of everything about us, and then about everything about everyone else, and everything else around us. If we can do that, then we are functioning as a soul and not as a person. Fully conscious. Well, that's a pretty hard thing to do. Most people are conscious at a level of 2% or less of the time. 2%? 98% of the time? Yeah, we're subconscious. Oh, my God, yeah, it's really crazy, huh? If you're spiritually disciplining yourself successfully, all right, and you've been doing so for more than, say, 6 months to a year, you're probably above 8%. Whoa, well, that's 92% now. If you want to succeed at the first level of spiritual service, which is called the first level of initiation by some people's favorites, you need to be 10% or so conscious. If you want to succeed at the second level, you need to be about twice that, about 20% after the first 6 months or a year. And that's because you're dealing with service that is more than just physical. It has to involve an astral issue to it, meaning you have to be able to spiritually discipline your own feelings besides your own interactions on the physical level with people. And that's a much more difficult standard. And if you're going to the next level of initiation, you got to add, you're going to be over a third probably in consciousness. And that's pretty hard to do. That's really, really up there. And if you're going to the next level, which is the highest that a human being can be, you got to be over 50%. Whoa. So then you're technically more a soul at that level than you are a personality. So that's how it works in terms of the numbers. Pretty scary numbers, because most people obviously aren't going to be up there in the high realm. And when we talk about converting personal relationships to soul ones, we're talking about within the realm of those particular numbers. Okay, so a successful soul relationship for someone who's functioning mostly just about physical interactions with someone else or some other people, would be meaning that 10% of the time they're going to be in that venue of service and functioning together. And that means that they are conscious that much of the time in their life. It doesn't sound like much, but, you know, human beings are far from perfect, and so this is what we can expect and hope for. Remember these low numbers, because they have a lot to do with this whole issue of the success in general that I talked about early on. So we can start seeing the grain and the grand scale of things, the great amount of difficulty there is for people to achieve these kinds of results together. Okay, so creativity and growth from that is the big problem for the personality. And the way to get over that is to live for creation of more of God as the first goal that we have, in deference to living for creation of some, we'll say, lower self value or something we want to achieve. And that's the basis. It's not that hard to understand these now. If you use the most simplest of ways to define them, which is what I'm doing, there's a little bit of an inaccuracy when you get to the simplification model, but not enough to cause us to go awry, because there's such a huge difference between soul consciousness and personal consciousness that we don't have to get down to the very, very finest details to come up with some, let's say, useful paradigms. And that's what I'm hoping to achieve tonight. This is a practical show. It's not trying to get to the absolute nitty-gritty, smallest things possible to explain about every one of these issues, because that isn't the goal I'm attempting to achieve on a radio show. Now, if we were studying this and somehow you're going to become grand teachers of some sort and you're going to have every idea and understanding of that's a different thing, not meant to be done in this venue. All right, so back to our point. Now, as an aside, I want to also mention, and sometimes people get confused by these, we'll say, exceptions, people who pursue an evil existence want to destroy God. And so they are very cautious about creation, because the only way that you can create that isn't destructive to consciousness is to either do one or two things. To emulate and attempt to become one with God, to be in that form of creation, so virtuous creation, we'll call that, or to be successful in the gaining of power over others who are attempting to do what I just said, and by being destructive to people who, in the midst of being trying to do good things, you circumvent through some creative effort their achieving that goal, so that you gain power from them in both their failures and in their destruction, if you can achieve it. So this then becomes the hallmark of evil, and kind of the exception to what I have said in my definition, because evil doesn't have a soul other than a group soul of evil. They don't have an individual soul. And so you could say they're converting over to a soul relationship, but it's the group soul of evil, not the individual soul, of the which includes the higher self. So they're going in the opposite direction. They have to be more cautious in their creativity than even the normal personality is. So they seldom create. And when they do create, they have to virtually be certain they will destroy the person or people or things or whatever you want to call it that represent virtuous issues or God. So they're not. It's not good enough for them to gain some control over or disruption, maybe make some money on, or whatever. Those things are irrelevant to what they have to do to increase their sense of control and to keep their consciousness as high as it has been. They don't care about growing it so much, but they don't want to lose it. So if they don't want to lose it, they have to be destructive to the good. Be very aware of what I'm saying now, because a lot of people have no understanding of evil. And they think, well, you just want some more money, or yeah, they want power, but they'll give up some of the power, provided that, you know, they can kind of get some of what they're looking for. It's all nonsense, cooked up by people who are totally subconscious, totally unaware of the truth. They're confused, and that's what evil loves. Evil, to maintain its level of consciousness, must destroy actively good. It has to destroy it. It's not an option for it to reach some kind of, you know, copacetic kind of compromised solution with good. It doesn't work for it. When it does that, it loses consciousness if it keeps its word. It's okay for it to do that while it stabs the good in the back and destroys it anyway. That's fine. As a matter of fact, that's kind of a cool thing for it to do. But it's not okay if it actually really keeps its agreement. So you can't expect evil to do that, because it loses consciousness, which causes it to suffer, and it won't suffer. It will destroy before it will suffer, for sure. Suffering comes from the awareness that one has lost consciousness. Remember that. And it applies to evil as well as good. Same definition. So don't think like, oh, they got a special case. They don't suffer. Well, they do suffer. So they don't want to lose consciousness. They don't care about gaining it either, but they don't want to lose it. And the only effective way they have is to destroy it. Now, some of you said, well, I read about that in your book. I still don't buy it. Okay, well, go get some deals with evil people and see what happens. You'll find out. You will find out. Okay. You know, some things can only be proven to those who fail to understand any other way than to actually putting their neck in the noose and jumping. Yeah, that's the only way they're going to find out. Okay. Have a nice journey. Now, so we dealt with that exception. And it's really not an exception because it still fits into the concept. It's just that evil has this unique way of functioning, which is so different from the rest of us. How many evil people are in the world? Not very many. That's the good news. But enough to really screw things up, if you allow. All right. Back to now. How, then, do we convert personal relationships, the soul ones, with all of these obstacles and other issues that have been discussed? The first is that one must be an example of a soul in a circumstance where someone is in conflict. Remember, I talked about what we call conflicts between people is really a conflict within themselves, between their subconscious self and their conscious self. Right? So the answer to our seeking a solution comes through that understanding. That understanding, remember, is the same as consciousness. You have to be conscious of this. So we need to stay much more in our higher self so we can be creative and find God-like solutions while others are in struggle that we are having a relationship with, and so whatever sort of relationship we're going to have. Now, we'll talk about specifics after the break. We're going to get a lot of practical specifics. But with others that we're having relationships with, when we can then, while we're in that relationship and while they're in the conflict, we employ the solution to us that is creative in God's light, is virtuous. That's how you do it. You become an example. And the example must be prevalent to the person by you discussing it with them, by you showing them it, by whatever, while they're in the conflict themselves. You might say, well, I've tried that. It works most of the time. All right, here, why doesn't it work sometimes? Matter of fact, much more often it doesn't work than it does based upon what I said at the beginning of the show. Again, 1 out of 5, if you're really doing good and the other person is someone that's, you know, it's willing to, wants to be closer with you, and maybe 1 out of 20 if they're kind of a distant kind of person you barely know. That's the kind of results you should expect, and you may not get even that. Right, so what is there that connects you together? And that is when the other person sees someone that they're close with is not internalizing the conflict like they are about whatever that conflict is. Remember, it's about control and fear of death. They see that that person isn't responding that way and that they are executing a plan of action and a way of emoting and a way of thinking that ultimately brings more light into themselves, into the world around them. That's the ticket, the first ticket to getting the other person to start becoming a soul with you. You're functioning as a soul if you're doing that. They start becoming a soul when they can get to that first stage. We'll call that stage one. Okay. Stage number one, I like it. Stage number one. Okay, now there's a second stage. Go to the second stage. Okay, let's say you've gotten that far. That's a huge step, believe me. It doesn't solve the problem yet, but it's a huge step. Okay, then the next step, stage two, is to get the person to feel the same way about the situation, or similar. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but similar, that you yourself do. So they have a desire to become more, or are motivated through their desire to become more as an enlightened being in their creations. So that's the next step. All right? Are you with me so far? All right. And then step number three is to get the person to change their thought processes, their thinking, to a new kind of thought that is employed in the construct of the concepts that you are using in your solution to bring more light into the world by co-creating with God. So in other words, first they feel like, oh, I got it. And, well, first they recognize that, oh, yeah, I can see, I can understand that this way of being creative is fantastic and different than mine. And then they feel a desire to want to do the same thing. And then finally, they start thinking in the same concepts. And how do you know they're thinking in those concepts? They can express the concept in a whole way. I'll give you a couple thought forms. A whole concept that explains what you're doing. They say, oh, the concept here is that first you do these three things and then do that and then do this other thing, and it all is creating more light. It's all producing more virtue. I got it. This is a good thing. So you got to step three now. That's the third step. Okay, the fourth step, which is the last one, is that the person must voluntarily co-create with you an additional amount that adds their personal responsibility in a way that is non-personal to the creative effort. So they personally say, I'm going to give you this much time and this much effort, and they show up and they actually do it, and the things that they're getting do not personally benefit them, but benefits others so that they can do something similar. And then you have developed a soul relationship at some level with the other one, the other person that you're dealing with, at those four steps. Okay, you like that? Because I can't put it any straighter. I can't make it any more, defined. You do those things, and every time you do that, you start building a soul relationship with other folks. All right, so we're going to come back in about 2.5 minutes and talk about all the different ways that this whole system can be employed, and we'll do so in 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com
or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're talking about converting personal relationships to soul ones. And hopefully you heard the first part of the show, the more conceptual defining elements of what I'm going to be talking about. And if you re-listen to them, the four points I gave are really kind of the conceptual framework under which I'm going to be further discussing, we'll call it more specific kinds of relationships, and where those four points may apply or may not, and how they interact with us and with other people. So the rest of the show is going to get a lot more specific and practical about the things that we've already covered in a less than practical way, maybe. But hopefully it all is practical if you apply it in your life. All right. So let's, I don't even know, there's so many different kinds of relationships, obviously, people can have. I don't know what would be the most important, but I'll just start picking them and we'll go on from there. I sort of like to start tonight with children. Our relationship with the young folks, especially if they are within the strong personal realm of being our parents, and we have a parental kind of contract, so to speak, with both society and the children themselves. It doesn't mean that we're only talking about parents and child. It could be grandparents. It could be uncles. It could be anybody that has a parental influence to the child. Sometimes it could be some teachers who teach young children. But for the most part, it's really the parental factor that I think I like to deal with first. A lot of times I wait till later to talk about children, and then it gets kind of rushed, and I don't cover the subject the way I like, so I thought I'd kind of get into that first so that we don't run out of time, because I think it's so important that, you know, it's those, they're the next generation, you know? And when we screw up, they've got to take over, right? So let's prepare them as best as we can. If you have children or you're in a parental position to children, this is really a big deal. And if we're going to try to convert a personal relationship to a soul one with children, we need to recognize that children's capacity to understand, we'll say, the soul is much more based upon our exhibiting actions and interactions than our teachings. So I know a lot of people are into, oh, I teach my kid this and that, I send them to Sunday school, all all those things are okay, and we'll talk about those too. But I love the poem by an unknown author, Children Learn What They Live. And that's a great poem. If you can look it up, it would be good for you to read that poem because it is so true. So they learn not so much by what you say, but by what they live in and through. If we can bring them into the creative process, co-creating with God, with ourselves, and they see us doing this with others as well, at different times, that's their living experience, and it is the best way to raise children. I know too many adults with children or parental responsibilities of various nature who don't get that. They think that their job is to teach, in a verbal way in most cases, their children in their life, rather than to be an example and to co-create with them at the children's level of creation, which is important to recognize. We'll get to that in just a minute. But so that's where the mistake comes in, and in my opinion. And you know, I don't mean to step on anybody's toes here, because so many people think that it's such an important thing, and I consider that the least important. Not that you can't do it sometimes, and not that it might make some kind of change, but if it's contradictory, to your behaviors and your co-creations with them and your creations away from them but that they see, forget it. You lose, because children learn what they live. And there's, I'm just laying it right out there. And I know some people are going to vehemently disagree with me. That's okay. That's why I have different opinions about things. And other people do. That's all right. But I caution you to to investigate what I'm suggesting, and do some tests in your life and theirs to see which is true. If you really believe, well, if I teach my kids, they'll just be fine, but I'll go in and live my life in a different way, and that won't matter. I'll even try to hide it from them. That will work, right? Sure. The point I'm trying to make here is you can figure this out in a month if you disagree with me. You should be able to make experiments and see how your children respond and what effects it has on them to teach versus to live. All right? And I would love if you would let me know your results of it. There's no question about that. So, that's the first and most crucial part of the issues at hand. And I would say that the majority of people are not on the side of what I'm explaining that I meet in their behaviors. Now, they may agree with me. They actually say, you know what? You're right, but I don't do that. Okay. Well, I don't want to be right. I want to help you to help your children. And this, you know, being right isn't going to change anything. I think the important thing is to make it so in your life so that it's in their life. Now, what about this business of hiding it? And I've talked to some people, you know, and this is I'm going to talk about the most sensitive area that I know of in this, where a few people are living together who are homosexual, and they don't, in front of their children, demonstrate what they think to be overt sexuality. So they think they're not teaching their children anything about homosexual relationships, and they're completely open, therefore, to the children are to having heterosexual ones or whatever they choose to have. It has, quote-unquote, no influence. And they may believe that it's so much a genetic issue anyway, that especially the children, if the children are not an offspring of at least one of the parents, then it's okay, because one of the parents is the offspring, and if they were already genetically chosen to be homosexual, it won't matter anyway. Interesting thought process, but here's the problem. Sexuality is not something that is just an act that takes place behind closed doors, often in the bedroom. The very fact you're in bed together is sexuality in itself, but the point is it happens between people just by looking at each other. They give off the energies necessary, sexual energies, for other people to sense them. You know that to be true, right? You know that. Well, your children sense them, too. They don't know or understand what the sexuality completely is, but they know they can identify with it because children have sexual feelings virtually from birth. But they grow, and they become stronger. You know that 2- and 3-year-olds do masturbate? What do you think? They don't have some sexual feelings? They don't understand them at that age to the level that anywhere an adult do. But the point is, they do. So what does this mean? This means that the behaviors don't necessarily match even the teachings. Let's say that the two homosexual parents say, you should make up your own mind about this. It's even better probably if you could live a heterosexual life, because then you can have children naturally together and all these other good things that go along with it. And we don't know if it's more godly or not, depending upon their viewpoint. But whatever, they can still give the child that, you know, teaching. But the teaching goes against live. This creates conflict and problems. Children learn what they live, not what you teach them. And so you got to look at this from a standpoint that there's a problem. Now, does that mean that I think the government should tell people they can't have children if they're involved in a homosexual relationship? Absolutely not. The government's got no right to be doing any of that crap. I don't think the government should be involved in almost anything that has to do with the quote-unquote creative freedom of an individual. And you say, well, but who's going to protect the children? You know, well, who in the heck is the government to know what's good or bad for any child? If the influence comes from the interaction of life, then you've got to know a whole bunch more about whether people are homosexual or not. Yes, it may contaminate the child to some extent in moving in a direction of being confused about their sexuality, which is the issue. But if the parents are superlative in soul matters and they're very soul conscious in so many other ways, they may be great parents, regardless of the sexual issue. So these are the things that I think it's important to realize. I picked one of the most controversial issues deliberately to show why it's important to recognize that children learn what they live, at the same time why that controversial issue can be mitigated by certain issues, and at the same time is not in the role of the government to decide. You see. All right, so getting back to the point at hand, how do we get parents to raise their children in a soul way, in a soul relationship with their children? Well, the first is to apply my suggested experiment and see if that's true, and if you go along with and believe it's true, the children learn what they live, to take it as a responsibility to live as a soul if you have children, because that is your responsibility to raise them as a soul. You can't raise them as a soul if you don't live as one, in my opinion. Now, that's a tough, bitter pill. Because the easy way out is to try to teach them in opposition to the way that you live. And that's just cheating, and it doesn't work. As a matter of fact, It produces rebelliousness in the child. Rebelliousness. To live in a way which is contrary to the way they are told and taught by their parents. If your children are rebellious, and especially if they're approaching or are in their teenage years, you have created the problem. Most likely, you have created the problem for doing this exact issue. I don't care who you are or what you argue to the opposite. I'm telling you, that's the problem. Solution. Okay, let's say you've been doing it. And you got a 14-year-old who is rebellious up the kazoo and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. Okay, let's say that's what's happening. How do you solve the problem? Please help me, please help me. Okay, I'll help you. You need to stop telling your children anything that is contrary to your actions. You need to admit the wrongfulness of your actions, at least, whether you're going to change them or not. Say, gee, I'm doing this, and it's not a good thing. And I apologize to you because I haven't been soul-like in my parenting. And then, as much as possible, in every way possible, carry out those four things that I suggested you do with your children at their level of consciousness. Remember, they're not adults. You've got to pick the level that they're at. That starts in Chapter 1 of Life and Meaning. You can read some other places about it. Where you function as a soul with them at their level, and you co-create with them. You pick and choose ways that they can be involved with, and then let them further be creative in the process of ways that you can create more light in the world together. Together. Let them function at their level. Remember that. Don't expect them, well, they're going to be adults just like you. No, they're not. You give them responsibilities or help them find them that they can achieve. Don't try to get them to do something they can't do. Well, he's 3 years old. He should be already doing calculus. No, that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. Right? And people do this all the time. It's nutty stuff. Children are children. So you let them be children, right? All right. So once you get them to the soul level, you must be sure, this is very important, you must be sure that the creation produces joy to the child. Joy. Joy replaces fun in the child's life. That doesn't mean they can't do some things that are fun, but fun things only feel good at the moment and don't continue on to produce the longer-term benefits that joy does. So joy is the minimal level of accomplishment as one of the guidelines that you're seeking. How do you know someone is joyful? When someone is joyful, they increase their level of risk and creativity against the fears of their personality, and they're willing to help others more than they were before they became that level of joyful. So joy increases the level of service to others, while it decreases the level of fear and your responsibility. Okay? That's how you know someone's joyful. Not because they're running around with a big smile on their face and say, I'm joyful. What people say is not as important, and what children say is not as important, as what you see in them. Children who are depressed, fearful, who have a sense of terror and fear and are irresponsible, are not joyful. So something's wrong then, for sure, and you've got the general gist of what's wrong. So you go back to the model of co-creating with God. Something isn't working. be careful not to make children overly responsible at the level of an adult for their co-creative matters. Make sure that their level of responsibility is at their level of capability. That's often times, even when people are doing almost everything right, that's a mistake they can make. As the adult and the parent, we need to be the guiding light about the question of capability and responsibility. If you try to make someone responsible for something they're incapable, they rebel and they get angry. And their anger will be at you. I'm sure you understand this. This is also true of animals, which I'm going to get to, I hope, tonight. So if you're going to attempt to have a good relationship with an animal, especially a pet, pet means an animal that its only purpose is for you to bring its consciousness into a higher realm. Bringing the animal closer to being human than not. If you're doing that, you have a pet. So if you're doing this with animals, be aware, as I hope you will be, that you cannot expect the animal to be any more responsible than they are capable of. They're not any different than children, except the animal has less capability than most children do, depending upon what age a child is. Certainly once the child is beyond two, for in most cases, that's true. And certainly beyond, say, three or four, it's always true. But animals just don't get beyond that. They really don't. Oh, I know people say, well, I have a dog. Well, unless you have a orangutan or possibly a chimpanzee, they're not going to get beyond 4 years old in consciousness. Those great apes can get to, or maybe if you had a gorilla, a mountain gorilla, it's possible. But they can get to like 6 or 7. That's about it. And even then, they're not even in their consciousness. Only some things are at that level of consciousness. So just don't assume, like, oh, I got a really smart dog, so it's capable of being the same as my 10-year-old. No, come on, it's not. But some people do. I know. I mean, look at I've been guilty of this. Oh, my pet can do this or that. Oh, yeah. Come on. You've got to look at it. What are they really capable of? Therefore, they can't be responsible for any more than that. Just today, the dog I'm living with, it's not exactly my dog, but the dog I'm living with, likes to take my reading glasses and chew on them. He wants to make sure I know he's doing that, too. And he grabs them. Just chews the tips off the earpieces so that they're uncomfortable for various reasons. Did so today. Then he left it by the front door to make sure that I noticed. All right, so there's an obvious behavior. Now, you could say, well, that dog is capable of communicating. If there's something he's disturbed about, like you're not giving him enough attention. Yes, I certainly agree with that. I do. But the dog is incapable of doing it in a way which is not fully, which doesn't entail some level of, we'll call it discomfort or destructiveness, small as it might be. And that's the difference. The dog is capable only of doing something that it can identify with as being uncomfortable to get our attention. And you can say, well, why can't it do the other thing, like a child would, of doing something nice for you over and over again and letting you know that it's really wants to work with you at that level. Well, that's an atypical response for a dog. And if it can do that, it's approaching the age of 4. Because that's the age where children can do that. At 3, they can't. They don't understand the difference between doing good things to achieve results and bad things at 3, but they do at 4. So if a dog can get to that level, it's functioning as a 4-year-old. And if it can get to the level where it not only can do a little bit of it, but it can complete it, it's functioning as a 5- to 6-year-old. That's a real unusual animal. If you've got an animal doing that, that's one of those really, really advanced dogs. And usually they have to be beyond the age of about 2 themselves, you know, like chronological age, to be able to even get to that point. So you don't know until they are about over 2 years old if they're going to reach that level. That's pretty high, by the way. Okay. So we look at children, look at our pets, and we see that we can really make a difference that's important to them and to us. And we can bring joy into their life, which is better than fun or some other kind of exciting kind of issues. I just wanted to mention to you, I'll give you a little rest on your brain for a few minutes, that if you haven't tried already, you can go to the Eye Center, Dr. David Stacy. He, along with Lorraine and Christy, his assistants, really helpful. They're really helpful about trying to get people to see better. And so they're persistent, which is good, because it's hard to see good sometimes, especially if your dog eats your reading glasses. And they're available at 2974 North Alma School Road in Chandler. And that's in the Phoenix area. So if you live in the Phoenix area, you can go visit them, theeyecenter.org. And their phone number is 480-899-0188. And give them a call. I think that you may find that they can be of assistance. Also, I haven't mentioned in a while, but if you have some level of discomfort or pain in physical sense, and you haven't tried Phygesic, that's Phygesic, G-E-S-I-C. Some people don't know how to spell that because it's unusual. It has that Chinese spelling, Q-I, yeah. And you can get it at Phygesic.com, 602-431-5762. The bottles are on sale. If they don't work, you get your money back. Hey, this is a good deal. Most people find they work for a whole range of painful kinds of situations, physical discomfort of various levels in various places in their body. Try it out and see if it's right for you. And for a lot of people, it works quite well, especially if you don't smoke cigarettes. It's more helpful than not. All right, so we're back to converting personal relationships to soul ones, and I hope that this is making a difference for folks. Let's move on to personal relationships of the sexual kind, sexual relationship with someone. Many of these we would consider to be either legally or otherwise as marriages. But if even if they're not marriages, but you have a close sexual relationship, not a one-night stand or whatever, that's a whole other thing, but one in which you're trying to develop that kind of relationship together, the elements of trying to create a soul relationship becomes even more critical. Because during a sexual relationship, you're exchanging energy, called sexual energy, with the other person, and in so doing, you're attempting to learn what it's like to be the other person, and especially if they are of the opposite sex, of what it's like to be the opposite sex as well. This is a whole other kind of dimensional issue to relationships. These kinds of relationships are more volatile, too, because they are more complete and complex. So there's more things that can go awry in their development. There's no question that adding sexuality to any close relationship brings about significant elements of change that can create good things or not so good things. And most of those are based upon whether or not it's a personal relationship or one of a soul nature. Now, when a person, when two people are exchanging sexual energy, that more than half the time that they're exchanging the sexual energy, now this doesn't count just in the bedroom or whenever they're going to have some physical act. It happens throughout the day and throughout the, all the time they interact together. Then that relationship, it's over half the time, in that particular way, is a soul level of sexual relationship. Very few people achieve this result. It's quite difficult for human beings to do it. But is it possible at all? Yes. Why is it so difficult to co-create sexual exchanges that are on a God or co-creative level with God? Because it doesn't involve just our sensual senses or our desire senses, which are astral senses, or our mental senses. It involves senses that are more Buddhic in nature, and that involves all sentient beings who have some sense at that level, and it involves God or virtue. So part of the reason, part of the motive for the sexuality has to exceed 50% in its part of wanting to create light in the world in the sexual act itself. Now that probably just threw a lot of people on their ear. What did he say? Oh, the heck am I going to do that while I'm having sex, because I just have all these sexual feelings, and then it's all about me, and it's all about the other person, but it isn't about God, and I don't know what it would make it like in the world. And yeah, that's the problem. Half or more of the, we'll call it motive, and also the actual energy expressed, has to be done with the co-creation of more light in the world together. Can't be on one side. It has to be both people doing it. If one person is capable of doing that, but the other person is not, it doesn't work. You don't get to the soul level, no matter what else you do. Now, you could say, well, this is pretty serious stuff, then. How many people are actually having these kinds of soul-level relationships? Well, not very many. But it's a goal. To achieve it requires mutual creative service in many ways, and you need to be continually involved in this exchange of energies throughout the days, weeks, months together, regardless of whether or not there is any actual sexual activity. So the expression of sexual energy is different than the activity of sex. And so that's part of it. The main part is co-service, but the co-service levels have to equal the 50% mark. The problem most people have is in that equation, because they may co-serve in various ways, but the co-serving together is the problem, because their personality, one or both personalities, gets in the way and wants too much to be in control. That's what, you know, it only takes one, even though the other one might not want, may want to, you know, say, forget about the control thing, I'm ready to co-serve with you. But the other person may say, no, I got to be in control, and they take too much control, and in that control, they sabotage the relationship of the co-service. And if so facto, that means like it's automatically going to follow, then when they, if they have a sexual act or acts or sexual relationship or activity, the it doesn't work because all of the, we'll call it spiritual foreplay, which is the co-service together, is being subverted by one or both of them being over-controlling, and the result is failure on the, in the level of the sexuality. Now, that's an important factor. And how do you get around it? Well, sometimes this doesn't resolve itself. But if it does resolve itself, it's in the person who is being over-controlling, or both, stopping that and being totally co-creative. And it's a tough thing to learn. How tough is it? Oh, my God, it's tough. There's a whole other series of things that people have to go through in their development to be able to achieve, get over this obstacle. So the things I'm telling you all out there who are in sexual relationships and want them to be soul ones, be aware of this particular problem. It's not easy to solve. You can't go off and do your own things and then, you know, get together and talk about them or something. That's not going to work. It has to be co-creative. Co-creative. Difficult to do. And usually, even if one person can do it, usually it doesn't work because the other can't. So it's not like you can have just one. You got to have both. They both have to function at the same level, voluntarily and completely co-creatively, not with one dragging the other person along. It doesn't work. Okay. What about during the action activity situation? Well, that requires what is known as tantric involvement, and it's really a concentration level of realizing that at the moment of the sexual activity, you're completing light in the world for something beyond the two of you, and it has to expand to the level of being involved with all the things that you have been co-creative with up to that point. That's why, if you haven't done it correctly, up to that point, the activity can't correct for it. Because it only builds on that. It can't be a substitute for it. Too many people think that sexuality is a separate thing, and it's not. It's part of our existence together. And there's no way around it. Okay. So let's say you get to that level. Then what? Wow, well, congratulations, by the way. Welcome to the very rare situation. Then employing tantric sexual activity means that your focus is on the soul nature of what you're doing, in part. Yes, you want the other person to be closer to you, which would be considered some personal interest, but it is incorporated and founded upon and predicated upon the co-service element and the fact that the lovemaking you are having is bringing more light into the world first and not second to whatever and all other senses of oneness and completion you have with the other person. And you cannot do this with more than one person. So if you want to get together with a gang of folks and have some kind of sexual orgy of some sort or any other kind of, we'll say, multiple partner sexual activity, those cannot be completed on a soul level because human sexuality and all others that involve light requires only one other person be involved in that activity, either when together or in a separate act of relationship issue. So you can't serially go from one person to another and say, well, I'm just with one person for right now. But in an hour, I'll be with somebody else. Nope, doesn't work that way. You are establishing a long-term commitment that connects your bodies, physical, astral, mental, and Buddhic bodies, together as one with the other person. All right. And part of that experience is becoming them, including the reverse in their sexuality, which homosexual people rob from themselves, so they can't get that part of the love. And then the result is that the oneness of their capability together sexually becomes part of their spiritual commitments and spiritual co-creations outside of sexuality. And it builds on both sides of the equation. This is a big deal. It can only be done with one person, one person, period, in a long-term sense, and therefore monogamy is a requirement. And no, you can't say, well, I'll give it a rest for a couple hours and find somebody else. No, it doesn't work. It undoes what you just did, and so you'll get nowhere doing it that way. So don't try to kid yourself or think that, well, there's exceptions to this rule. I know we can have multiple partners as long as we wait 24 hours. Crazy nonsense. Not true. Okay? So, those are the issues. Now, what about let me cover the other side of this. What about people who are not achieving this? Should they be just willy-nilly go have sex with anybody? And the answer to that is no, because you are still acting as an obstacle then to the future development if you think there's any possibility of it happening. And even if you don't, be aware that the more you have sex with different people, the less chance you will ever have spiritual relationship that is on a soul level. Okay? We're clear on that. I hope that's clear, because I've heard other people with different things. So you can't have tantric sex with anybody you feel like by the minute or week or month because they're having a session next week in some town where you're going to go to. It's all nonsense. If you're going to go do that, you might as well just call it what it is. Oh, it's a fun orgy over at Swami's blank blank, and I'm going to participate. That's what you're doing. Call it what it is. What other types of relationships do we want to probably try to get into tonight's show? Well, what about the relationship of people who are, we'll say, closely related through spiritual group work and would be considered almost a spiritual service? Group of some form. There's many different forms. Those kinds of relationship groups require a soul nature among the participants, and in general, they have to be equivalent to the capability of the people and the type of group it is. First level initiative groups have to function at a 10%, etc. I gave you all those numbers at the beginning of the show. And those numbers apply. When we have circumstances where people in a spiritual group choose to function as personal individuals rather than as souls, the danger to themselves is high, because they are circumventing their commitment and responsibility to God. It's not about the group. I know a lot of people say, well, isn't it, they're being irresponsible to the group, they're hurting everybody in the group, and blah, 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 blah. That's all true, but it's really not the big picture. The big picture is, you do this, you're doing it against God, and if you think you can step on Superman's cape and get away with it, good luck. The results are almost always devastating. It is better to not be in a spiritual group, and if you're going to be both irresponsible and worse, detrimental to the functioning of that group, than it is to either leave or not to be in one in the first place. If you're going to be in a spiritual group, you need to look at that fact that it's the responsibility has tied to it tremendous implications should you ignore it? And some people just don't get that. You know, they say, oh, I was so bad. I did two good things today, even though I did four bad things. So who cares? No. The issue here is that if you consciously decide that this is your life to live spiritually, and you want to do so with the assistance and also the co-creation of other people, this becomes the hallmark, the very reason for your existence. If it is not the reason for your existence, and if you find, well, I exist to do this thing or that thing or 20 other things, and this is what I really care about, I care about whether I feel this or I get this or I have this, then you've got serious problems, and the universe is made up in such a way, unless you're evil, that you're going to get some serious kicks in the butt for it. Bad karma, lots of problems, health problems galore, I guarantee that, and a tremendous amount of, we'll say, misfortune. Why? Because you're basically saying, in the most hypocritical forms, that you understand, to some level, know well enough that these things you're doing are not good, and you still choose to do them. Well, I forgot, or I got tired, or I got angry, are very bad excuses. The kind that usually result in, we'll say, significant negative karma acceleration. Why is it acceleration? Because the more you have contradictory understandings, the faster the karma hits. You want to accelerate your karma? That'll do it. For real. Unless you go evil. Go evil, you can slow it down for a lifetime or two. But that I'm not suggesting is an alternative to solving the problem. I'm saying the alternative to solving the problem is to spiritually discipline yourself if you're truly in a spiritual kind of group, because that's the only way to solve that problem. With spiritual discipline, it is possible to correct these things, especially when there's other people there to help, assuming there's a leader to the group, and especially if there's some teacher available. But in either case, you can't, and don't expect those folks, the teacher or the leader, to come to you and fix it. Yeah, it's a matter of solution first, then go to them with where you failed. I failed here, I failed there. Can you help me? Let's set up a time and talk about it or whatever. And that's when you do it. The first thing is you got to take responsibility. I know too many people, well, I asked for help. Yeah. But I was doing a lot of bad things anyway, and I kept doing them because what the heck? Until somebody else takes over the responsibility for them, I'm not going to change. Call it karmic acceleration for sure. Nothing will produce worse results than doing that. Seriously. You're going to see bad things happen quickly. And it will affect the group, too, that you're with, the other people. They are involved with what you're doing, but at the same time, it's going to seriously talk about the ton of bricks coming from nowhere, lay on your head. And be aware, this is what takes place over and over again. I've seen so many cases of this. It's unfortunate that I have seen so many. But it's a fact. And nobody can stop it except you. And should you consider being part of a spiritual group if you can't handle these sorts of things? No. For heaven's sake, no. Spiritual responsibilities are such big issues. They employ and come with very bad consequences. They have to protect everybody. That's the way the universe was created. You may not like it. But you can test out my theories if you want. I'm not suggesting you ruin some spiritual group or trying to go get involved, but you can observe others, or if you're already in this situation, look at yourself doing it and see what happens. You'll see what I'm talking about, sure. Okay, so that's another unique kind of situation, but it's important because it's of the people who tend to listen to this show. All right, so let's move on to the more, quote-unquote, mundane aspects. Well, there aren't any really mundane ones, but what about people that live next door to you, the friends you associate with but not on a very close intimate level? What about all the people that you work with or that you go to school, if that's what you're doing, or what those kinds of associations? How do you convert those relationships to more soul ones? Because you're not intimately involved with these people. They're around. You may go to lunch with them and talk about things. What can you do to bring them closer to a soul relationship together? Well, the first is to be open, both in mind, in communication, and in actions. This allows other people to, if they want to, become closer to you. If they don't know anything about you, and you're not willing to let them know anything, that's not going to happen. So this openness is a big issue. It means that you've got to be somewhat fearless because personalities don't want to be open with people that they're not really close with. And then you might ask, well, how are they ever going to develop a soul relationship, which always requires very close things because you're co-creating more of God. Well, that's the point. I'm suggesting you change your ways. We all do. And we treat people as souls right from the get-go, even though that may not turn out to be very likely to happen. It may not happen virtually at all, but it's worth the try. Yes, some people may gain information and become hostile to you and do terrible things to you. Well, that's okay. Because as long as you're co-creating with God, those things will be of minimal, if any, consequence to you. They may produce some bad things for themselves in trying to do that, those other folks, but don't worry about it. You can handle it. So an openness that may be peculiar, odd, is important because it allows people to get closer to us and to have the choice of becoming more a soul by saying, gee, you know, I want to co-create with you. I want there to be more virtue. Now, most people are going to run and hide. They're not going to do that. But for the few that don't, you've opened the door for them, and you're willing to take whatever chance, quote-unquote, or risk your personality might be fearful of in being so open. Now, you don't have to tell people things that you're committed as in a secret sense not to say based upon certain other commitments of other people. No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying you let people know who you are and how you co-create with God so that they are invited in to do the same with you or with the others that you are doing it with all together. This is, again, that example issue. How you become the light to them. Now, some of them are going to get afraid. Well, I don't want to do that. That's too scary for me. I don't know how I'm going to handle that. No. Okay, fine. Just let them go their own way. They've got their thing, and that's it. But others, a few of them, will say, you know what? I'm free on blank, blank day, and I can have this much time and energy. I have this much money. I have this much things that can contribute. I got all kinds of stuff. I'm ready to go. Can I come? Can I do this? And I've also got ideas to co-create. Here's some things that maybe will be helpful. That's what you leave open. And it has to be, on their part, voluntary. No, you can't just sit there with a litany of things that you suggest they do to try to convince them to come on over. That doesn't work. What will happen is that, oh, yeah, I'll be there. And then about 5 minutes before they're supposed to show up, phone rings, or maybe 5 minutes after, oh, I can't make it. But I told a friend of mine about what you're doing, and they said next time they'll show up. You know how many times I've heard that one? You got to be careful not to laugh in their face, but it is funny. Okay. Here is the point. People talk, but they don't act. So, yes, some people are going to say all kinds of things. Oh, I want to do that. I really do. You never hear from them. That's okay. Don't get angry about that. Don't get upset. That's part of the whole thing about the personality control and no problems. And then some people actually do commit, but they do the crazy stuff I just said. They don't show up, or they come, they're supposed to be there for 8 hours, and they come for 8 minutes, or who knows? This is, again, the personality fudging, pretending like it's a spiritual person when it's doing virtually nothing and oftentimes taking from others. Be careful if people are taking from you not to let them get too much, too far. Then you have to stop them. You just say, no, you can't do this, you can't do that, because you're taking, and that's not good. I would be making you less of a soul by participating with you in that way. So the word no is very important to people who live spiritually. Don't think that you're just a yes person, you're a no person to those people who are selfish, unconscious, self-centered, lacking, we'll say, in humility. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or if they have, we'll say, a tendency to exaggerate their capabilities or their initiative efforts or anything like that, be aware. And don't participate or let them participate unless you think you can go down that road to some extent to get them to realize that that's what they are doing. That's permissible, but don't count. And in any real sense, those people are going to be acting as a soul with you. You're just trying to get them to see that so they understand that they are not. But sometimes they are deluding themselves. They're not just hypocrites. They're also, we'll say, delusional about who and what they are doing. So just be aware that that also is a part of wisdom in this kinds of circumstance, and you need to be wise about these issues. You want to be wise, and it's important to be. All right, so those are the kinds of things we want to be, we'll say, proactive in developing, and it happens every day to at least me. Any place I go, I have these opportunities, and I try to present them to people. It doesn't mean that it's very successful. These are the ones that fail the most. Don't think, oh, guys, let's Niles is out there, and he's got all these people that just suddenly turn around and are, yeah. I talk, and most people turn around and run away. Oh, my God, that guy wants me to serve. Forget it. Service? No, I don't know how to wait like that. It's a show. Yeah, okay. I get that response much more than I get anything else. All right, let's talk about another kind of relationship. What about those people who are bosses or have some kind of authority position in a mundane sense over us? They may be teachers, and in a grading sense, they have some authority over us. Or they may be police people or the people running things with rules from the government and all this stuff. How can we relate to them and try to develop a soul relationship with people who believe they have authority over us? Now, this gets into a touchy area, because you risk recrimination, penalties, fines, imprisonment, if you are unwise in the way that you deal with this particular subject. When others have some means of recrimination and some means of punishment, your first concern needs to be the damage they do to other people when they abuse those authority positions. Your first concern should not be how it affects you on a personal level, but how these people are affecting society in general. Your fights against them, if that happens to be necessary, if you see this going on in its, we'll say, dark, it should be non-personal. Do not make it personal, or you'll end up in prison, or fined, or in some way seriously harmed. If you make it non-personal, you run some of that risk anyway, but if you make it non-personal and you look for ways that other things control these other people, some laws or rules beyond what they're using to enforce on you, then you have some opportunity to make some important changes, both in their life and in society in general. That is the responsible way to bring in a soul way of existence. Sometimes it involves legal issues. Sometimes it involves interactional issues that require, we'll say, brinkmanship and a good deal of negotiations. But regardless, you're all the time attempting bring more light into an area of darkness, and not on a personal level. If you make it personal, you run the risk of high levels of recrimination. And once that risk is breached, you lose the ability to stand as a soul, because you'll be in a position of having to personally defend yourself. You do not want to be in that position. Keep it on a soul level, which is wise, and that will be minimalized to a very low level, and you should be, in most circumstances, safe from the recriminations. What if the other person is positive in their response? And they say, well, yeah, I have the authority of this and that, but, you know, I can see what you're doing is really right, and maybe it's against some rule I believe in or some law. But, you know, the things you're doing are really good things. I'd like to help you out. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Man-made laws are not God's laws. I write about this in Chapter 1 of Life's Hidden Meaning. They are not God's laws, and what they are many times an aberration of God. It's our job to try to bring to the light the aberration without being destroyed in the process. If you destroy your existence by imprisonment or some kind of physical violence or whatever against you, you haven't accomplished in a virtuous way the co-creation of God. I don't care how many people stand in the arena getting eaten by lions, that is not going to help develop more souls. I know some people think it did at some time in the past. And maybe for that particular situation, you could make some arguments about it. But in general, in today's world, the best thing is to deal with these things in a more mental fashion and take it down to an astral and physical level, which can be quite dangerous. All right? How do you convert personal relationships to soul ones among enemies? Let's say you're Israel, and you've got Iran saying they're going to wipe you out as soon as they get their first nuclear weapon. You're going to be the test site for their new missile and nuclear weapon. What do you do in that kind of situation? How do you create a soul-level relationship with someone who says that their existence is dependent upon your complete destruction? Well, first of all, you recognize that they're evil. That's the first thing. If you don't recognize they're evil, you're never going to solve this problem. Okay. Now, why I say that? It seems like such an obvious answer to the solution, right? I got to recognize they're evil. Well, few people today can see evil at all. And so they can't recognize it, much less understand it. So the first thing is to recognize that it is evil for a country to say they want to destroy another country because they don't like them, or for any reason, for that matter. And they don't, they, you know, if you got to wipe out 6 million or 8 million people, I said, okay, it's all well, I'll just do it. You know, I got as soon as I get my nuclear weapon all made up. How do you deal with that? Well, evil is responsive to souls, believe it or not. You want to break their relationship with their group soul. What does that? Fear. You have to make them more afraid of you, your soul, you on a soul level, than they are of, we'll say, their need to destroy, which really comes from a group soul in the background. So you've got to kind of break or shatter this connection, and fear doesn't. How do you make someone afraid that is evil? By continually challenging their ability to stay conscious by forcing them to become more and more creative in ways in which they're going to fail. You have to know this ahead of time. You have to know and understand ways to defeat the ways that they are destructive. And you've got to make sure that they got the message. If you're Israel, you point all your weapons at them, you say, on this day, at this time, you don't exist anymore. Have a nice day. And so, now, you don't want to really give them the exact time, but I'm talking about this more in a metaphor. And so, and when that time comes, you wipe out their navy. And then the next thing is you wipe out, well, I'd actually wipe out all their missiles first. But, I mean, you know, you do something that takes action that shows that their power is not creative enough to be able to defeat what they're trying to do, which is to destroy your existence. So you've got to make sure that's possible. But you also make it clear before you have to initiate the act of violence that they have an understanding of it. So you're not really completely hiding what you're going to do, but what you're doing is you're making sure that they can't stop you no matter what, and that you're not going to be manipulated, say, by the United States because you got a dark president in office who thinks that evil's really a cool thing. Just use it the way you want it so you can get reelected or whatever else you want to do with it, and maybe that makes you evil too. If you got that going on, you just ignore that guy. Or maybe tell them a bunch of nonsense until you do what you need to do. But whatever you're going to do, you've got to make sure the other side becomes afraid, because the fear is really of them having to become so creative, they're going to make many mistakes. And the mistakes will become fatal to their connection with evil. That will cause them to break off their connection with evil, and possibly their soul can get through. This is the issue of force. Force is necessary to deal with evil in the physical world. You know, that's a difficult thing for some people to realize. This is in Chapter 8 of Vice and Making. Force is necessary in the physical world. Some people say, well, I'm a nonviolent person. I don't want to use force. Fine, that's great. Wait till evil comes in and rapes and kills everybody and does everything. You can keep up with that and see how long it works for you. If you want to bring evil to the point of reaching back to reconnect with its soul, remember, it doesn't have connection with its soul, and to give up its group soul, if you will, force is necessary in the physical world. Isolation and restriction is necessary in the astral world, and truth is necessary in the mental world to deal with evil. But here, in the physical world, force is necessary if that's what's going on. Sorry to tell you that. There's more explanation of the concept of that if you read it. I don't have time tonight to go into it because I wish I did. But that whole concept would take about 10 minutes to explain it. Not going to get that tonight. Okay, so force is necessary. All right, so let's say you've got that far with this particular issue. And let's say they have, so to speak, backed off, either because the fear is great enough or because the force was strong enough. You wiped out all their missiles, and now they don't have missiles, so they can't deliver the nuclear weapon if they get one. What is the next thing? It's planning. You have to outplan them. You have to have consciousness that's so much greater. You can't just function at their level of consciousness. You have to function way below that level, way beyond that level of consciousness. And so planning means, okay, they're going to have a nuclear weapon on this day at this time or this month or whatever, and we're going to make sure they don't have any nuclear weapons at that time, and it will require these 9 things to do. I'm not going to name them because I prefer not to. But the point is, you come up with a plan, and the plan has to be so overwhelmingly better in consciousness that the other side has no alternatives that are viable, livable for them. No alternatives. Why do you want no alternatives when you're trying to give choices to people who are in connection with their soul? Because you have to reverse the concept when you're dealing with evil. Evil has to have no choices, whereas they can have one choice or 5 choices, but those choices have to be the choices you have decided they're going to have. Not, they have no choices that they have come to on their own. Okay, I have to be careful how I explain these things. So that's the message you must convey, and it must be part of your plan. The plan has to be genius, not some kind of small thing, and it's going to need to meet the circumstances at hand. So if you have an enemy, and that enemy is anywhere near evil, these are the things you need to do. Less than evil enemies have less than extreme examples, but they still fall closer to the side that I'm explaining. And an enemy is not someone that you dislike. It's someone that is destructive to you being a soul. Do not get confused by that. Just because you don't like somebody or they don't like you, they are not necessarily your enemy. It's only someone that's against you being a soul or against people in general being their souls. That's an enemy of God. And we are all here to defend God's growth, which is life, against the enemies of it. Remember that. We're all here for that. All right, you know what? We're running out of time for tonight. There's a lot of other relationships I would like to have gotten to, but again, another show at another time, we'll talk about them. Hopefully tonight you've gotten how to convert personal relationships to soul ones, and maybe for the next few days you can all think about this and come up with some other ideas yourself about how to deal with these relatively difficult parts of being here, especially in the physical world. A little easier in the astral, a lot easier in the mental, but we're here now, and this is the time to be dealing with them. Okay, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.